The headlines. Iran says Persian Gulf states are capable of securing waterways. There's no need for the presence of extra-regional military forces. Public mourning is announced in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin as another Palestinian is killed after being shot by Israeli forces. And four soldiers are killed and four more injured as Israel launches a new airstrike targeting the vicinity of the Syrian capital, Damascus. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran says Persian Gulf littoral states have the potential to secure waterways and maritime transportation in the region away from any foreign intervention. The foreign ministry spokesman said in his weekly presser that the security of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman is a priority of Iran and is achievable through regional cooperation. Nasser Kanani said that Iran is willing to launch a collective regional security initiative in the Persian Gulf. He also dismissed as false the claim that foreign military presence in the region is aimed at ensuring its security. Kanani said foreign powers like the U.S. pursue their own interests and their presence has brought more insecurity to the region. The U.S. Navy says over 3,000 of its military personnel have arrived in the Red Sea aboard two warships. The Navy's Fifth Fleet said the sailors and Marines traveled to the region on two warships via the Suez Canal in a pre-announced deployment. It's the first time U.S. naval forces are dispatched to the region in nearly 2 years. The U.S. announced the deployment of the warships along with F-35 and F-16 warplanes to the Persian Gulf last month. Washington is also reportedly weighing proposals to station forces on commercial tankers transiting the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman. The U.S. has locked in tensions with Iran in the region. Iran considers U.S. military presence as a security threat along its sea borders. Sir Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator who joins us. Sir Mohsen Abbas, welcome to the program. When you take a look at the deployments, it's said to be that it's aimed at, to target Iran, so to speak. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, if one of the reasons they say is because Iran wants to stop these oil tankers in their transit there, isn't the U.S. the one guilty of stealing oil from Syria and therefore being one source of instability? And yet they believe that Iran is the one that's creating instability. It just doesn't really jive with the reality on the ground.
Well, the U.S. is the biggest destabilizing and insecurity-creating force in that region, along with partners, the rest of the Anglo-Zionist Empire. But, they will justify it by saying that we are here to protect the 20% of oil that passes through the Straits of Hormuz, and with their established U.S. exceptionalism or the Anglo-Zionist exceptionalism, they expect to be able to do things that no other nation can. If the Iranians were to say they were to go onto the coastal areas around Cuba or whatnot, where the Americans are, and start pushing their weight around there, how would the Americans respond? Of course, everybody has to protect their own maritime territorial waters, and it's a fact that the Iranians are more than capable of doing that on their own. The United Arab Emirates and the Omanis, who have the other share within that strait in terms of waterways, are also very wealthy and capable of having navies that can do that. So what's the question that one of the major military officers, Mr. Bergeri, asked was, what's the purpose of the American Navy in territorial waters that don't belong to them? I mean, the only purpose is obviously a belligerent asymmetric warfare that continues against the Islamic Republic of Iran primarily, and they continually use excuses. I mean, these latest incidents, let's just go through them very quickly. The ships that have been scrutinized by Iran are done under a legal methodology and practice. The tankers Niovi and Purity were seized over separate sort of legal disputes regarding ownership, for example. The another one, the Advantage Suite, was held up because of a collision it had with Iranian ships. But of course, the Americans want excuses to put Iran under pressure, and they've gone as far as to actually attack Iranian military and other ships in that region Notably, April 1988, they launched an entire barrage of missile activity against the Iranian forces doing their job in that region. So the Americans' belligerence is well known. And them moving in F-35s, F-16s, a new battleship in the region, on top of the U.S. Fifth Fleet, which is stationed in Bahrain, is clearly aimed at being a direct threat to Iran. This is what all this is about. And the Iranians, of course, are no slouches. They're saying this is our jurisdiction legally and on an international level. So what are the Americans doing pushing their weight around where Iran is simply doing its job in controlling the security of that region in terms of shipping?
You have two factors here that I'd like to get your take on, and I'm going to combine it into one question. The one factor is the fact that we're looking at Iran that has, normalized ties with Saudi Arabia. Pretty much all the neighbors, if not all, I shouldn't say pretty much, all the neighbors in Iran, with Iran, they are all in sync in terms of their relationship. They all have friendly relationships. So that's on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have the incident that happened back in 2016, if you recall, where there were some American sailors and they were seized, and later, about 15 hours later, they were released. And I don't know if you recall the video of how they were captured in that incident, but later on released. Since then, Iran's military might, along with its naval might, has increased quite exponentially. So when you put all these together, why would the U.S. want to pursue a route that is not going to really have any success in what it even wants to send as a message, which is to intimidate Iran?
Well, it's because this is all they have left. These are acts of desperation. There was a time when you had, of course, the Americans able to push their weight around and their military power mattered. But now we're obviously going to get into a situation where, of course, Iran has corvettes, it has missile capability, it has frigates, it has submarines, it has fast speedboats, which the IRGC Navy controls, and they are capable of doing a lot of damage. The Americans know this. This is why they won't push their luck too far. So it is foolishness. It is kind of a drunkenness of imperialism that just makes America continue in this way. They'd be well advised not to. Iran is running exercises with Russia and China on a maritime basis now. And this is the new world that is coming, not only on land, but at sea. The Americans will not have it their own way. And the Iranians are absolutely determined to keep their sovereignty, and they'll do it by any means necessary. And if the Americans were to engage in any kind of military warfare, it threatens a much more broader war really flaring up very, very openly.
Thank you very much for that. It's a pleasure. Thank you. Sima Sinabas there. We appreciate it. Political commentator. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister says the expansion of ties with Japan is important and in line with Tehran's policy priority of developing relations with Asian countries. Amir Abdullahian made the comment after his arrival in Japan for meetings with the country's top officials. He's already held talks with the country's prime minister and foreign minister. The visit is aimed at boosting bilateral ties and discussing regional and international developments. Amir Abdullahian arrived in Tokyo early on Monday. His trip coincides with the anniversary of the devastating U.S. atomic bombings of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. To mark the incident, a delegation from Tehran's Peace Museum will attend the ceremonies as representatives of Iran. Earlier, we discussed the significance of the Iranian foreign minister's visit to Japan in our news review program. Here's what our guest had to say. Pi Sing So is a convener, Society for Advanced Study of International Relations, joining us from Hong Kong. Also, we have Emmanuel Pestrike, who's the president of Asia Institute, joining us from Seoul. Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may. He's saying, and ask you, in terms of the relationship that exists between Iran and Japan, why is that important? Iran has said that Japan is very important. Not only has history shown that, but also in the context of Iran's importance that it has given to Asian countries.
Thank you for inviting me to the interview. I think Iran recently has adopted a more assertive diplomacy. in order to promote his national interests. Okay, for example, Iran has diplomats has sent ministers or even the president have visited the Latin America and also Africa, the three African countries, and even as before, as China as mediator, Iran has cooperate with a good relationship with Saudi Arabia. So I think Iran is in the national interest to adopt a more assertive policy, diplomacy, to promote its economic interests. And Japan is also a very important partner for Iran. Especially, I think Iran wants Japan as a mediator to ease its attention of the United States in the long run. For example, in particular, to get rid of some sanctions against Iraq.
Emmanuel, let me ask you, when it comes to the ties that exist between the two countries, for example, in the past, Iran has relayed to Japan that it can be a provider of energy resources for that country. On the economic side, there's a very healthy relationship there. My question would be, on the political side, obviously, there has to be differences because there's a close alignment when it comes to Japan and Western countries, in particular the U.S. Well, there's a divergence, obviously, to say the least, when it comes to Iran in terms of that arena. So how do you see those coming into play here in their relationship?
I think the decision to visit on the occasion of the bombing of Hiroshima is the most significant part of the puzzle, that this is the one point on which Japan profoundly disagrees with the United States, which has never taken responsibility for those bombings, and which has engaged in an enormous $1.3 trillion modernization of its own nuclear arsenal in blatant violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So from Japan's perspective, it would be, in terms of security issues, would be far more in alignment with Iran's position and more sympathetic. And my guess is that there's an attempt to sort of play to the deep Japanese ambivalence about Americans' nuclear posture, and maybe to use that as a way to overcome Japan's obvious alignment with the United States, which has been, I think, brought into question, or at least there are questions arising in Japan today, and I see it around me all the time, as the United States moves in the strategic command towards a position of preparing for a nuclear war with Russia, and conceivably with Russia and China, which would be suicidal and certainly not in Japan's interest.
All right, that's a good point that you raised there, Emmanuel, which I want to address to our guest there. He's saying the fact that Iran's foreign minister's trip coincides with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, obviously that's something that is a sore spot for Japan and Iran in the sense that it is fully a believer of civilian nuclear energy. And given the fact that the U.S. has never apologized, do you think that that is one of the ways that Japan and Iran bond is somewhat closer, or they find maybe amicable or mutual similar liking there when it comes to the two countries?
I think Iran and Japan, for the time being, I think they will focus mainly on the economic times and also how to ease the tension between Iran and United States through Japan as a mediator. On the nuclear weapons, I think for the time being, it is not mature for them to resolve the problem because is the present geopolitical atmosphere does not favor such a negotiation in terms of the tension between United States with Russia and also with China. I think Japan is still under the umbrella of the United States, so that Japan cannot put a high tone to mediate or for the middle, intermediary with the relationship between Iran and the United States for the time being.
Thank you very much for that, Manuel Pastrike, president at Asia Institute from Seoul. And He Sing So, convener of the Society for Advanced Study of International Relations from Hong Kong. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in. The young Palestinian succumbs to his injuries after being shot by Israeli forces several days ago in the occupied West Bank. The young Palestinian has been identified as 17-year-old Ramzi Hamed. According to Palestinian sources, he was shot in the stomach by Israeli troopers while in a vehicle near the entrance of the town of Silwad, east of Ramallah. Separately, a public mourning has been announced in Jenin for three Palestinians killed by the regime's military. Israeli troops carry out attacks against Palestinians across the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. The regime has killed more than 200 Palestinians in the raids since the start of this year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier gave us an update on the situation in the occupied territories following the recent wave of Israeli crimes against Palestinians.
Hamad was shot in the abdomen and he was transferred to hospital. We have to mention that his father has been arrested several times before, and unfortunately, recently, he was held under administrative detention without charge or trial. This policy allows the Israeli authorities to keep Palestinians behind bars for an indefinite period of time without knowing why they had been arrested in the first place. About over 215 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli forces since the beginning of this year. Over 40 of them were Palestinian minors, less than 18 years old, had been shot and killed by the Israeli soldiers. Today in Jenin area, a general strike and a day of mourning had been declared after three Palestinians had been killed by the Israeli forces. The Israeli military sent undercover units in order to kill those Palestinians. Clashes erupted, however, an exchange of fire. However, the three had been assassinated, and the Israeli soldiers took their bodies with them before they left the Jenin area, specifically an area between the village of Arabi and Bir al-Basha.
Israel has carried out an aerial attack on Syria targeting the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. According to the Syrian military, the regime missiles were launched from the occupied Golan Heights. The military said the country's air defenses intercepted and shut down some of the missiles. The offensive, however, left four Syrian soldiers dead and four others injured. It also caused some material damage. The Israeli regime frequently targets the war-ravaged Arab country, particularly in and around Damascus. The Syrian government has for a number of times called on the UN to force the Israeli regime to stop its aggression. Damascus says the assaults are in violation of international law and are aimed at propping up terrorists. Tens of thousands of people have gathered in Niger's capital, Niamey, to express support for coup leaders as a deadline by the West African bloc for a military intervention expires. The crowd gathered in a stadium carrying portraits of Niger's junta leaders. They held French flags with a red cross through it in a sign of an end to the country's decades-long military presence. Meanwhile, the junta said it had closed Nigerian airspace as of Sunday until further notice. Junta leaders cited the threat of military intervention from Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. The regional bloc had given Niger coup leaders until August 6 to reinstate former President Mohamed Bazoum, but junta leaders had rejected the deadline. And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Did women also play a role in the event of Ashura? February 8, 2010. Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, did not have to endure the psychological pains that Zainab al-Kubra went through. On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali, Abbas, Ali Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains, the invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, "Oh my Lord, save me." On the day of Ashura, she said, "Oh God, accept this from us." While the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, "Oh God, accept this sacrifice from us." When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, "I did not see anything but beauty."
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God. See how different this position, this patience, and this love of justice and truth are compared to Asiya's position described in the Holy Quran. This shows the greatness of Zainab's position. This is the nature of actions that are carried out for the sake of God. Therefore, Zainab's actions are currently a model, and her name and achievements will remain until the end of time. The permanence of Islam and the divine path and continuation of this path by God's servants are based on what Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam and Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, did. That is to say, as a result of the great patience, resistance, and endurance of hardships, you see that religious values have gained a lot of ground in the modern world. All these human values, which are consistent with human nature in different schools of thoughts, are rooted in religious values. These values have been promoted by religion. That is the nature of efforts for a divine cause.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Documentary produced by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement revealed that Palestinian resistance fighters managed to infiltrate Israel's Shin Bet, a spy agency Mossad. The documentary titled Spider's Web 2 details a complex espionage operation that was carried out against the Israeli organizations by Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Palestinian resistance movement of the Islamic Jihad, which is headquartered in the Tel Aviv-blockaded Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. The documentary illustrates the espionage enterprise, which involved six Palestinian fighters and was part of a wider operation launched by the Islamic Jihad in 2022 to retaliate against Israeli warfare in Gaza. The Israeli military launched close to 150 airstrikes against the coastal sliver during the war, prompting the resistance to respond by firing some 1,100 rockets toward the occupied territories. The Palestinian agents reportedly baited a number of Israeli officers into revealing secret methods and procedures. One of the Palestinian operatives, referred to as Recruit 106, duped a Shin Bet officer into believing that he was afraid of being arrested by the Palestinian resistance fighters, thus luring the Israeli officer into revealing a treasure trove of information on the regime's security system, methods, and tools. The Palestinian agents also managed to find out how Shin Bet agents had, in the past, tried to pose themselves as Palestinian Authority officers, Jordanian intelligence agents, and even a European Union representative on one occasion. According to the documentary, the Palestinian move led to the detention of several agents working for Israel and the dismantling of at least three Israeli spying centers. The successful conduct of the operation, according to the documentary, led to the Al-Quds Brigades debunking the myth of might that surrounds the Israeli regime and its capabilities, with the Palestinian fighters identifying the regime as no more than an illusion made of dust. The term was famously used by Mahmoud Al-Arida, one of the six Palestinian prisoners who successfully escaped an Israeli maximum security prison in September 2021. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet, which took power in late December, has thrown Tel Aviv into unprecedented turmoil with its push to overhaul the regime's judicial system. Many of the former senior officials present at the December conference have become highly public dissidents, warning of the damage to Israel's security by the agenda and even supporting the refusal by thousands of military reservists to serve the regime. By every metric, the Israeli economy has suffered, while scientists, doctors, and tech entrepreneurs either prepare immigration plans or march in the streets alongside hundreds of thousands of their fellow citizens. The Israel Medical Association said nearly 500 doctors are expected to leave Israel, warning that the exodus can lead to a severe medical crisis. Israel is no longer as strong or as stable as it was mere months ago. Israeli opposition leader Benny Gantz recently warned of a worrying security situation across the occupied territories amid a months-long wave of anti-regime protests sparked by Netanyahu's far-right cabinet and its contentious policies. Last week, after Israeli parliament passed the first of the judicial overhaul bill, sparing mass protests, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah described it as the worst day in the history of the Zionist entity. He said, Israel has embarked on a path, God willing, of collapse, fragmentation, and doom.
Rating agency Fitch has downgraded the U.S.'s credit rating over its rising debt and a, quote, deterioration in the standards of governance. Fitch is one of the big three rating agencies. It has dropped the credit rating to AA+, down one notch from the highest rating AAA. The lower credit rating could over time raise borrowing costs for the U.S. government. The lower credit rating provides investors with a guide of the risks associated with investing in the debt of a particular country. The move could cause investors to sell U.S. treasuries, leading to a spike in yields that serve as references for interest rates on a variety of loans. Fitch has pointed to the expected fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years, a high and growing general government debt burden, and the erosion of governance relative to other countries with similar rating over the past 20 years. Fitch predicts a growing government deficit, noting that the U.S. debt-to-GDP ratio was currently at 100.1%, 2.5 times higher than the AAA-rated country's median of 39.3%.
It is important. It is relevant. The question is, of course, is it the canary in the coal mine for other similar downgrades? And I would say, is it a lagging or a leading indicator? I mean, this dance around the debt ceiling goes on year after year where we're quite familiar with it. It's not a surprise. It was actually less drama this time around than before. So why is it now that the governance has been called out? I do think it's significant that it's been compared to other developed economies, because the governance, is it demonstrably worse here in the US than other developed economies? Or is this just, it may perhaps it falls short of what it should be?
Fitch has also cited the Federal Reserve's recent credit rate hikes, weakening business investments, and a slowdown in consumption to predict a mild recession in the fourth quarter of 2023 and the first quarter of 2024. The decision was viewed by observers as another embarrassing blow to the U.S. government, which had long been rated as one of the safest borrowers in global finance.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is a steady deterioration that we've seen in some of the key metrics for the United States for a number of years. Debt to GDP in 2007, general government debt was less than 60%, and now it's 113%. So there's been a clear deterioration. Furthermore, we're expecting fiscal deficits to rise over the next 3 years, and we expect debt to continue to rise over the next 3 years. And furthermore, because of the higher interest rates and the higher stock of debt, we're now seeing the interest burden rise pretty fast, actually, in the case of the United States. So the underlying numbers are, especially on the fiscal and debt side, are quite negative.
Fitch's downgrade comes roughly 3 months after U.S. President Joe Biden signed a deal to raise the debt limit, just days before the U.S. was expected to default on the national debt. The last time the U.S. credit rating was downgraded was in 2011, following a similar budget showdown that came within hours of the government defaulting on its debts. The reputed credit rating agency has warned that the growing debt, which is now well over $32 trillion, and Congress's inability to manage it in a productive and responsible way pose threats to the country's creditworthiness. Both administration officials strongly criticized the rating cut.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the decision was arbitrary and based on outdated information.
Its flawed assessment is based on outdated data and fails to reflect improvements across a range of indicators, including those related to governance, that we've seen over the past 2.5 years.
The White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, said Fitch's decision defies reality when the U.S. had the strongest recovery of any major economy in the world. But U.S. stocks have taken a nosedive after Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded the country's credit rating by a notch from AAA to AA+. An index designed to track turns in U.S. business cycles fell for the 15th straight month in June, dragged down by a weakening consumer outlook and increased unemployment claims, marking the longest streak of decreases since the lead-up to the 2007-09 recession.
But the bigger picture, Fitch has exactly right. We are on an unsustainable fiscal path. The ultimate consequence probably isn't a missed Treasury payment, but it's probably a disastrous run of inflation when we try to monetize a debt we can't afford.
The Conference Board, which is a leading business membership and research group organization, has reiterated its forecast that the U.S. economy is likely to be in a recession from the current third quarter to the first quarter of 2024. Elevated prices, tighter monetary policy, harder to get credit, and reduced government spending are poised to dampen economic growth further. Since inflation is still higher than the Federal Reserve would like it to be, policymakers are widely expected to raise interest rates by another 0.25 percentage point. These rate increases make it more expensive to get a car loan or to finance a business or to carry a balance on a credit card.
Muslims in the United Kingdom have criticized the country's banking system over its discriminatory policies towards them. Campaigners say British Muslims have been disproportionately denied banking services. They say the banking of British Muslims have been closed without adequate transparency and recourse. The Muslim Council of Britain has written to the Prime Minister, Chancellor of the Exchequer, to opposition parties, and the Permanent Secretary to the Treasury, expressing deep concerns over the arbitrary closure of bank accounts belonging to Muslim individuals and Muslim organizations. In the letter, the MCB highlights the recurring issue of banks withdrawing services from British Muslims over the past decade, with adequate transparency and recourse for those affected. The MCB said, "We urge for an impartial review that not only addresses the mechanisms behind bank closures, but also examines why British Muslims are disproportionately affected by this issue." The letter also says successive governments have ignored the banks withdrawing services from British Muslims, and the practice had persisted without adequate transparency and recourse for those affected. The MCB's intervention comes after figures from Britain's Financial Conduct Authority named Muslims as the only faith likely to be unbanked in Britain. The criticism comes amid the backdrop of a controversy which erupted after a prestigious bank in the UK closed the account of right-wing politician Nigel Farage. He's the former leader of the UK Independence Party, a right-wing political party that campaigned to take Britain out of the European Union. Farage's bank account was shut down by Coutts, owned by NatWest Group, over the alleged disagreement in political views. The boss of NatWest Group apologized for the bank closure. Following the incident, the government announced plans to force banks to explain account closures. Farage had put in a request to the bank to see documents relating to the decision to close its Coutts account.
To the start of this, that it wasn't right for people to be deprived of basic services like banking because of their views. Now, ALT isn't about any one individual, it's about values. Do you believe in free speech and not to be discriminated against because of your legal views?
Critics say the apology and explanation offered to Farage highlights the double standards toward Muslims in the UK. While Farage received a 40-page report regarding the closure of his account, many Muslim charities, they have not received the same explanation. Muslim charities have been facing bank closures for over decades and are often policed by banks and their policies.
My conclusion is there can really only be one answer. It was Muslims, British Muslims for the most part, who were having their banks removed. And of course, British Muslims don't count. Whereas when Nigel Farage has his bank account removed, that's headlines in the mainstream media, and cue a wave of sycophantic, sob story columnists coming into action to say, poor Nigel.
In recent weeks, Muslim faith-based charities and pro-Palestine solidarity groups have highlighted they have been subject to bank closures for years as a result of their political views without a major backlash from politicians or the press. HSBC closed the account of Finsbury Park Mosque, and other banks refused to take the mosque custom, despite no law having been broken. Islamic Relief, one of the largest long-standing Muslim charities, was also debanked by HSBC. In 2015, the Palestine Solidarity Campaign had its bank account with a cooperative bank closed. Palestine Solidarity Campaign is the UK's most prominent pro-Palestinian action.
And I have people who wept describing the humiliation of it and the consequences for their own families. I've spoken to people whose charity has been wiped out. Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, the Finsbury Park Mosque, very respectable organisation in Islington, North London. The mainstream media totally ignored the story. I often press journalists, friends of mine in the media, please run something about it.
Reports now say the political turbulence plaguing the UK Conservative Party over the last 2 years has slowed its internal efforts to tackle Islamophobia. The study by Swaran Singh, a former Equality and Human Rights Commissioner, has found evidence of discrimination and anti-Muslim views at local association and individual levels.
According to a new poll, public confidence in the U.S. military continues to decline, reaching its lowest point in over two decades. Only 60% of Americans expressed a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the military in a recent Gallup poll conducted from June 1st to 22nd. That's down from 64% in 2022. After the 9/11 attacks, military confidence increased and remained high at mostly above 70% for two decades in America, before dipping to 69% in 2021. The confidence level has further declined since then. The poll linked the decline to the United States' poorly executed withdrawals from Iraq and Afghanistan. Many analysts have also attributed the trust deficit to Washington's heavy arms supplies to Ukraine, which has been engaged in a war with Russia since last February. Last month, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Kaul acknowledged that the United States' military aid to Ukraine has placed the country's arms industry under strain. According to Kaul, Washington has provided nearly $40 billion in military assistance to Kyiv since the start of the war. Over the past 48 years, Republicans have consistently shown the highest levels of confidence in the military, but in just the past 3 years, Republican confidence plunged from 91% to 68%. Independents, who historically held moderate levels of confidence, now have the lowest trust, with public confidence dropping by 13 percentage points to 55%. Though confidence among Democrats rose after President Joe Biden took office, that gain has dissipated over the past year. The results mirror a crisis of trust in several other public institutions. The military still evokes the highest public trust among the 14 other institutions included in the poll. Five institutions stand as the least trusted, with newspapers, the criminal justice system, television news, big business, and Congress all garnering confidence from less than 20% of Americans. Congress, in particular, registers the lowest confidence at a mere 8%. This year's confidence index reflected a 4 percentage point decline compared to last year, when an American think tank rated the U.S. military's level of capability as weak, saying it was incapable of winning a single war against arch rivals China and Russia, let alone two concurrent ones. The report prepared by the Washington-based Heritage Foundation only appraised the Marine Corps as strong, while giving the Army a marginal rating, evaluating the Space Force and Navy as weak, and finding the Air Force to be very weak. Also, with public support falling, the armed forces are struggling to fill their ranks. Leaders from the Army, Navy, and Air Force told a congressional hearing in March that they all expect to fall short of their recruitment targets this year. The children of military families make up the majority of new recruits in the U.S. military. The pipeline is now under threat, which is bad news for Pentagon's already acute recruitment problems, as well as America's military readiness. This year, the U.S. Army expects to end up about 15,000 short of its target of 65,000 recruits. But what are the underlying causes of the U.S. military recruitment crisis?
Unfortunately, only about 23% of young Americans qualify these days to go into the military, and a lot of that is about obesity. And some of it also is about just only about 9% of young Americans are interested in serving in the U.S. military. So it's a lot of things wrapped together.
According to a Pentagon study published in March, 77% of the 16 to 24-year-olds typically targeted by military recruiters are unfit for service due to lack of physical fitness, low test scores, drug use, or poor mental health. Also, experts believe that the sexual assaults that occur in U.S. military bases and the arrival of white supremacists to higher military ranks are among the most important reasons that led to the reluctance of young men to go to military service. American officials are now concerned that this trend would lead to undermining the state of preparedness of the country's military forces and may have negative repercussions on the reputation of the U.S. Army.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mir Bagheri. Stay tuned.
متعال می‌فرماید که ولی من شما رو برای این چیزها نیافریدم، برای اینکه برده نفس بشید، شیطان رو بپرستید.
In Surah Al-Zariyat, Ayah 56, we read, I did not create the jinn and the humans except that they may worship me. Based on this ayah, Allah did not create humans to follow the Satan or be tempted by the worldly desires. In better words, Allah gave humans the capacity of servitude, which is high in rank. Even when referring to the Holy Prophet of Islam in the night of Mi'raj, Allah calls him his true servant. This shows that being a servant of Allah or a true worshipper of Allah is not an easy task.
بندگی خدای متعال انگیزه های مختلفی داره، درجاتی داره، همینطوری که در
Of course, according to different narrations, there are several types of worshippers who follow different motivations to worship Allah. Some of the worshippers act like the tradesmen. They worship Allah to gather worldly rewards. Their servitude to Allah is mostly because of their desire to be successful in this world. Their worship to Allah is good, but it is not of a high rank because Allah has put more capacity in the humans to worship Him and to promote the quality of their servitude. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mir Bagheri. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Zionist lobby's maximalist strategy targets all areas of public life in its efforts to suppress criticism of Israel and whitewash the atrocities perpetrated by the settler colony. The lobby even targets the music industry and attempts to destroy the careers of artists who dare to speak out in favour of justice for Palestine. So in this edition of Palestine Declassified, we'll be exposing the key players behind these malevolent manoeuvres. First up is this report by Latifa Abu-Chakra about the Zionist lobby's Machiavellian tactics that have led to Palestinian musicians being banned from Spotify.
The Zionist lobby has successfully pressured the music streaming giant to delete pro-resistance Palestinian music. To do so, the lobby groups We Believe in Israel and the Board of Deputies have enlisted the help of the British government. It first became apparent that the lobby was targeting the platform when We Believe in Israel, a project of BICOM, announced that it was demanding the removal of British Iraqi hip-hop artist Loki from the streaming service in March 2022. While the attempt against Loki failed due to significant public backlash and celebrity support, the lobby group escalated their campaign and succeeded in removing the work of Palestinian artists Shadi El-Biruni and Qasem El-Najjar. We Believe in Israel, which is led by former arms industry lobbyist Luke Akehurst, boasted of the achievement in a press release with the Board of Deputies, in which the organisations claimed they had even lobbied the British Minister for Culture on the issue. A fact the gloating press release failed to mention is that the British Minister for Culture, Lucy Fraser, was previously an intern at the Israeli Ministry of Justice before being appointed to the British government. Following the removal of these Palestinian artists, seemingly with the help from a British minister, Luke Akehurst made clear that Loki is still in his sights, commenting, "Now we need them to look at why they are hosting explicitly anti-Semitic and conspiratorial songs by Loki." Akehurst was a consultant for arms firm Finn Mechanica, also known as Leonardo, which has billions of pounds worth of deals with the Israeli military. We Believe in Israel has also acknowledged working with a range of stakeholders, including the Israeli embassy. The parent organization of Akehurst's lobby group is BICOM, which has coordinated with the Israeli embassy on anti-BDS campaigns in the UK and is currently led by Richard Pater, a current reserve in the Israeli army and former employee of the Israeli Prime Minister's office. The campaign manager at We Believe in Israel, at the time the drive against Loki began, was Rachel Blaine. Today, she is the Director of Public Affairs at the Conservative Friends of Israel. Before working for We Believe in Israel, Blaine worked as a public affairs intern at the Board of Deputies. Interestingly, she notes on her LinkedIn account that she worked as a press assistant at an unnamed international embassy in London, where she researched various media groups and platforms. Prior to that, Blaine had worked for the Zionist Federation, where she created dossiers to counter anti-Israel campaigns. Considering her previous and current employers, it is likely that the embassy where Blaine worked as a press assistant was the Israeli embassy.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Kit Klarenberg, who joins us via Skype. Kit is an investigative journalist exploring the role of the intelligence services in shaping politics and perceptions. He's also the editor of Grey Zone UK and writes for a range of other publications. The day after his last appearance on the show, Kit was subjected to a sinister move by British police. When he arrived on a flight from Belgrade into Luton Airport, he was detained and subjected to an extended interrogation about his political views and his reporting. But his ordeal hasn't deterred him from his groundbreaking journalism, and we're delighted to welcome him back onto the show today. David, Latifa referred to Britain-Israel Communications and Research Centre, that's often abbreviated to BICOM, as we know. I mean, can you just say a little bit more about them? I know we've spoken about them before on the show, but just say a bit more, if you can.
So BICOM is the main PR agent for Israel in the UK. It was created in 2000 at the start of the Al-Aqsa Intifada by a whole range of different Zionist organisations who came together to start this kind of PR agency. So it's been in existence now almost 23 years, and it has funded to the tune of millions every year, and it plays a key role in misinforming the British media and indeed British politics about what's happening in occupied Palestine. So it's a very important element of the Israel lobby, along with all the other organisations, the Community Security Trust, the Jewish Leadership Council, the Zionist Federation, who form the main body of the Zionist movement and the Israel lobby in the UK.
Kit, I mean, what do we know about the campaign to get Loki off Spotify?